My name's Stephen Neal, pastor at Alden Bethel Church and blogger at Building Jerusalem.
And my name's Stephen Watkinson, church planter in Rochdale and blogger at Northern Souls.
So, several months ago now, when we were doing the sort of former version of this, I think the first version of this podcast, and I guess we were talking about polity and our different views of polity, and that was back in the days when you were an Anglican, and now you are moving towards independency. But even then, you were talking quite a bit about membership and the importance of membership and how you could see that that was perhaps a little bit more important than you maybe previously thought it was. Can you just sort of tell us a little bit about what's changed your thinking on that and how things have changed for you from your days as an Anglican to now?
So I think initially there were things that were, I suppose you might call them pragmatic, in that as you were doing stuff within ministry, you were thinking, this is hard because I haven't got a definition of what it means to be a part of the church. Now, you kind of do, and I'm sure we talked about this in Anglicanism, you kind of do, but there's quite a lot of issues with it.
Could you just flesh that out a little? So what was your definition back then, and how's that changed?
Well, so in a sense, it's not hugely different, except that it works across a denomination, in that you make a bunch of promises when you're baptized, straight confirmed, about what you believe. And having been baptized and confirmed, you are then a member of the Church of England, if you like. And they probably don't quite use the membership language, but it's that, for example, that you need to take communion. It's that you need to be on the PCC and stuff like that. And that's fine in a kind of, and it's good, in a sense, until things start to break down in terms of what has actually been done with people before those things happen across different churches. And the fact that because you're a denomination, you're accepting someone's membership from another church in your church. Does that make another local church?
So your church. If I happen to be C of E and my C of E church was in a parish immediately next door to yours, I could potentially confirm somebody and baptize them or whatever. And then they're a member of my church, but technically they're a member of any C of E church, right? Depending on whatever parish they're in. And so I could be denying the Trinity. I could be denying the resurrection. I could be teaching all sorts of false doctrine and saying, yeah, all these guys are fine too, who are also denying that along with me. And then they rock up to your church and they would see themselves as members of the Church of England, of which you are a part, and therefore entitled to all the privileges of membership of your church. Is that about right?
Yeah. And again, in principle, that, if you have a system of discipline that's working across a denomination, that's okay. So if you've got, like you say, someone in the next door parish who is teaching something that isn't right, and someone, they can be disciplined. And if you have someone who comes to your church who's believing stuff that isn't right, then, they can be disciplined. But when you don't have, again, you're really relying on a denominational structure there. And of course, one of the things that I think everyone knows about Church of England is that, well, the only thing you're disciplined for these days is being faithful, as far as you can see. But that's probably a bit harsh. But so that isn't working. And maybe even more to the point, a lot of people would be baptized or confirmed just with very little input. So it'd almost be because there's an element of desperation that says, well, it's great if we're baptizing people. It's great if we're confirming people. We don't want to set the bar too high for that. We just want to welcome people in, sort of thing. And then, of course, the problem is you get someone who may be a lovely person, who may have, in lots of ways, have done it in good conscience, if you see what I mean. But it never really was explained to them what they were doing. And then it's really difficult because you as a minister don't have the power to roll back what's been done. Only a bishop does. And then if you can't, you know, that causes, unless you've got a coherent denomination in terms of membership and discipline, then that's really, that just gets really, really difficult. And what tends to happen is that you sort of end up ignoring it and the edges become very fuzzy as who is a member. And you end up sort of trying to, or hoping perhaps that some people don't want to be on the PCC and don't want to help in different areas. And, you know, you have some control, but not, it makes the membership, like I say, not necessarily, but in practice, very fuzzy. And so pragmatically, I was coming to this situation where you have all these people who think that they're members of the church who maybe haven't, you know, grasped the gospel, or, you know, maybe, you know, it's not always easy to tell whether they've grasped the gospel or not, but you would be persuaded to think, well, given what being a member opens up, then let's just see if you have grasped the gospel or not before we open the door to you being able to take communion, for example. You know, it's just not a great thing. You know, I preached a number of times about not taking communion when you shouldn't, but had people who I think were probably taking communion when they shouldn't have been. And again, you don't have any much control over that. You can go to your bishop, you can ask them, you know, you can in an emergency stop them from taking communion. But then when you do that, you then have to go to your bishop and ask them for, in effect, permission to excommunicate them. You know, which is just, it's just, and the chances of you getting that these days on most contacts, you know, not that high, all that kind of thing. So just, I think once you've allowed a bit of a vague idea of membership, and then you've allowed to get it into it to get in a mess, pragmatically you start to experience all kind of difficulties where you start having to throw your weight around rather than, it sounds wrong, but you basically kind of go, well, I'm not letting you do X, Y, and Z, and I can't stop you from doing A, B, and C, which I'd like to. But instead of being able to kind of go, well, look, these are our standards, you don't hold to them, therefore. I just, there was a number of those sort of issues that made me think about it.
So would you see membership, sacraments, discipline as all kind of part of a piece where one of those goes wrong, the other things go wrong, and would you see them as entirely separate issues that aren't necessarily related?
I think they are pretty closely related. I can understand where people would differ slightly on how they drew lines and things like that. But for example, given that you are looking for, say, roughly speaking, if you were saying that membership means, you know, sort of clearly professing Christian, that's what you're looking for in a member. Well, you need to be that, don't you, to either be baptized or have your children baptized, depending on, you know, obviously your take on that, to take, you know, communion, to sort of work as a church in that sense. And also, it is quite hard. I mean, I suppose one of the things that struck me was messy is, how do you discipline if you're not clear? So denominationally, because we weren't clear about what was right and wrong, to be honest. So there's a problem. And of course, obviously what happens, I mean, this can happen in any context, but, you know, there are contexts where you might try to kind of say, well, actually, you know, because of what you're saying, we are going to withdraw, say, you being able to do X, Y, or Z. Well, they can just go down the road, because church down the road in the same denomination doesn't mind that you're, this is what you're doing or whatever, or maybe even will actively encourage you to do that. So they, that kind of clarity, as soon as you lose a bit of clarity at one level, so I don't know, suppose you lose the clarity that which the church room has in practice, that baptism of children is for the children of believers, for example. So you lose clarity on that, then you end up in a mess, don't you? Because you've baptized someone into a non-Christian family who's got a non-Christian example going on. And, you know, where does discipline then come when you've kind of at the start not said there was an issue and all those guys? So, yeah, it's hard not. I can see people might, some people might want fuzzier or sharper edges on some of those things, but it's hard not to see they're pretty tightly related.
Yeah, so that's kind of where you were coming from. So what has changed for you then? And in what ways has your view on those things been different? And kind of as someone who's moving towards independency, has it been your move towards independency that's caused you to change your view on those things? Or has your view on those things kind of led you to a position that says independency is the best way to achieve those?
Okay, that's quite an interesting question, actually. I mean, like we just said, so I'm moving in that I was moving in that direction. And with a certain amount of caution in that, I think it's possible to draw the lines of membership too tightly. I think, you know, and I've seen that. I think it's possible there's some thinking that, you know, I'm probably still doing to a degree about, you know, you don't want your church to be exclusive in the wrong way, but you do want it to be, I suppose, maybe exclusive or faithful and protected in the right way. So there's some thinking along those lines. And so in that sense, I probably had moved quite a lot on membership anyway before moving towards independency. But in a sense, what you're asking in a way is, it's a bit similar to, I think, when we were talking about episcopacy. You know, part of me was then looking at the church and going, well, I can't see how that can work for me in this situation. Do I think it necessitates independency? No, I'm sure there are people in Anglican churches around the world who would kind of be going, well, that's not how it works here. And fair play to them, you know, that they have a tighter sort of definition on that, or, you know, better clarity on that within their area. But again, I couldn't see how I could get that clarity in a Church of England context in the UK. And with that, having said in previous podcast or a couple back, I can't remember, I wasn't very confident of any of the Episcopal setups. So if you're going to be an Episcopal, I mean, it's quite tightly linked into that. If you're going to be in an Episcopal setup, then you have to rely on your episcopacy with your church discipline, with your sort of keeping clarity on things like membership across that setup. And again, it isn't clear to me, even in the things that I think are quite good in terms of episcopacy in the UK, it's not quite clear to me that that is going on all that clearly.
So my question was then, so you said you don't think independency is the only way to achieve those things. I think that's fair. I'm not sure I'd necessarily say that's the only way to achieve those things either. So what is it that pushes you in that direction then?
Partly because I think it's was going to say respectable way of doing it. I don't know if respectable is quite the right word, but
no one said we're respectable before, I'll be honest.
But you know what I mean when I say that? It's a reasonable way of achieving something. I think especially in days of small things, you know, where I think it's just, again, I mean, I think I've probably said this before on Episcopacy, this problem of, small numbers of good churches around the place, making it quite difficult to act as anything but independent. So what are most Anglican evangelical churches doing? They're acting as independent churches, but under a legal framework that prevents them from doing some of the important things as independent, like discipline. So you end up in this mess where you're acting as a kind of congregational-ish and independent-ish, except that when real troublesome things strike, you can't do anything about it. And you know, every respect for Presbyterians in the UK, but it would feel quite difficult. I mean, you know, if you drew a circle round us in Rochdale, trying to include a reasonable number of Presbyterians, it would have to be quite a big circle. They're around. I mean, yeah, I suppose I'm ignoring the United Reformed Church, but
you look, if we were to ignore those, I guess you're looking sort of direction of Sheffield, aren't you, and Salford, which is sort of...
So Sheffield, Salford, Blackburn, yeah. Kind of thing, which, you know, I mean, it's fine. And I know, you know, we live in a Zoom world now, don't we? But it would be pretty hard for those guys are a long way away to know what's going on and that kind of thing. So you are, I think, again, even in that kind of context, I think you're very likely to, in effect, be a congregational church. And now they're going to disagree with me, I imagine, quite strongly on that. But you know what I mean? You would, day by day. I think it just pushes you in the circumstances that we're in. If you're willing to say, look, I think this is a reasonable, respectable, whatever the word is, way of approaching it in terms of congregationalism. And the situation that we're in kind of is moving us in that direction anyway. Then, and what it's probably worth saying, I do mean reasonable in terms of biblical, in that, you know, I do think, I understand some of the arguments for different kind of takes on it, on church government and how you do that kind of thing. And obviously hear those from my kind of Episcopal friends. not friends who are bishops, but those who are in Episcopacy. You know, if you're willing to kind of say, well, working out a faithful biblical model, there's scope for a bit of variation, and a congregational model is okay, so long as you think carefully and biblically about it, then, which I do, then, like I say, I think they put that alongside the fact that practically that's what you're looking at anyway. Then that seems sensible to me.
So I would say then, as an independent, you'll be going into not only an independent, but a plant, which is literally starting from scratch with no church culture, no church background. It's just a new entity. How do you see these things playing out then in practice? I was going to say, if you were setting up, I mean, you are going to be setting up. So given that you are going to be setting this up, what will that look like in practice, or what should it look like in practice?
Clearly, and I think we said this before, it could be really dangerous, couldn't it? So it could be that I was my own kind of lone ranger type church planter, and I set things up, and it was allegedly, you know, we had a model of discipline, allegedly we were congregational, allegedly we had elders or whatever. In practice, I ran the show, and you know, you couldn't brook any contradiction with me, kind of thing. And you do see that. And I think a lot of people who would come from, say, a Presbyterian or an Episcopal thing would probably want to point to that and go, yeah, surely you're just opening yourself up to those kind of dangers, which I think would be true. And I think that's why it matters in our context that we are planting out of Bethel. that we therefore from the word go have a fully formed eldership over us, a fully formed membership situation from the word go, if you like, and discipline therefore from the word go. So we're not we're not making that up on the hoof. That's already there. And the point where we become actually independent is the point where we have those things in place for ourselves, clearly defined in a way that the eldership that we're under is happy with and the church that we're under is happy with. Mm. And so in that sense, we are locally accountable. And that's just something that's mattered to me. I think, I don't know, I suppose I maybe haven't said enough about this, but in terms of both our experience and our investigation into what we did next and that kind of thing, that the reality of having local, properly local kind of accountability, support, it just, that became very high in our priority. Because ironically, as someone who was part of a denomination that has all those structures in place, what I experienced was less and less of that, because as soon as you start to have serious questions about your bishops and your archdeacons and that kind of thing, which, you know, inevitably loads of us in the Church of England do, you start then looking to informal networks for accountability. Well, that they don't actually have any real accountability. They're just kind of friendship networks who, you know, might say, oh, I don't think you should do that, Stephen, but that's about as far as it goes. And if I disagree, then I'm going to go, well, there you go then. And I think I want that. Having said I want that for myself, I suppose taking it back to the membership thing, I think I just increasingly wanted that for my people. I spent years working in Church of England churches and grew up in them and so on. Now, the good Church of England churches that where people have stuck in for a long time, they have, in a sense, pretty good kind of membership and, because they're teaching and discipling their people and often because they're powerful enough within their diocese to do what they want to do anyway. But one of the things that I was looking at is that lots of guys going to work in churches where, you know, the members, if you like, of their churches just hadn't got any and had never had any of that sort of real accountability, real knowing what it meant to be a member, being expected to live in that kind of way. And just in general, thinking about the church in that kind of way. And I want that for some of the guys that might come with us in Rochdale, that they would, you know, just have real clarity that, you know, being a member of the church, it means believing these things. It means that those beliefs affect your lifestyle, not you're perfect, but that you see what is sin and what isn't sin and you repent of your sin and all those kind of things. And just as I want that kind of local reality, I think I want those guys to have that within a church where the church is therefore serious about discipling them. And not just happy that they're sitting in the seats.
And so let's say you set this up, how would you see membership, discipline, eldership working? Because obviously at the point you go as a plant, yeah. I would say if you're teaching the word and you're baptizing and you're handing out communion, you are functioning as a church. That is what you are. But you're not functioning as an independent church until you've got your own governance. You're effectively a daughter church until such time. And so my question is, at the point you become independent, how would you view your polity looking? What would you expect that to look like and how would it function?
So I would think we couldn't go independent until we'd met a few criteria. One would be that we had a clear definition of what membership meant, and we had a clear group of people who were members. And that we understood that, and the church understood that, if you see what I mean, as in, you know, that was part. I think it's quite easy to have a collection of people meeting together without a clear understanding of who's who and who's what, you know. And I think you've got to get to that clear understanding within the church community. And maybe within the church community, sort of saying, well, actually, there's a set of people who aren't members. They may come every week, and we may even think that they might be believers, but they're not willing to sign up, or we're not sure about something, or whatever. But so there's clarity that that's how we do things as a membership. I think we would be looking at having elders in the plural. So yeah, obviously I am aiming to plant, and the likelihood is that in terms of salary, it will be me. But you're looking for at least, I mean, I would say at least a couple of other godly men who are properly able to act as elders with a clear understanding of what that means between the three of us. And that kind of clearly set out. Because again, there's a whole set of risks with that, aren't there, in terms of, yeah, there's three elders, but there's me, and then there's two people who are yes men to me, or something like that. And I think actually, if you're going to get it to work, you've got to have two other people or more or whatever, who actually, if they outvote me, then I lose. Kind of thing. I think that's probably why ideally you want a couple, because I think if it was two, you might just disagree, and how would that work, kind of thing.
We have functioned for a time with two elders, myself and somebody else, and it is possible, but it's not ideal. I think it's mainly because of relational dynamic, to be honest. The other guy I was with was a really godly, helpful, solid bloke. Not a yes man, but very much a supportive guy. So he would say no when he thought no, but nonetheless generally wanted to support what direction we wanted to go in. But even in those circumstances, relationally, it's just an odd dynamic. Because at the end of the day, if you do disagree over something, one of you has to just say, okay, fine, I will give way. Whereas if there are three of you, or an odd number of you, or a larger number of you, there's less likelihood of that happening. So it's not ideal, but it is workable, and it is certainly preferable to just having one.
Yeah, and see, again, it's just lesson learned in terms of Anglican ministry. It's an odd setup. But once you are the vicar of somewhere within the ministry of the church, you do what you think you'll do, and you're supposed to consult with your PCC, which is sort of your, it's a bit hard to say what your PCC is in biblical terms, can be a kind of mixture of eldership and diaconate, I suppose, but you don't have to take any notes of them whatsoever. You can do whatever you want. And some people have taught that up as a really good thing if you're wanting to turn a church around and stuff, but it's not particularly good for ministers. Because
or churches, really.
Well, say, which is the consequence of that, isn't it? Because it's not good for ministers, it takes a great deal more godliness on the behalf of the minister to not make quite a lot of bad decisions and stuff. But yeah, so I mean, I think you'd be looking at some of those things being in place. I think within that, again, obviously you need some kind of clarity about your constitution. So how does that then work? You've got a membership, you've got elders. How do you get the elders? How do you make decisions as a church? What role do the members have? And all of that. And you may, I mean, you know, other people would look at adding deacons and things, wouldn't they? You have deacons, don't you?
We do have deacons, yeah. I mean, our church is I don't like the phrase, but it's journey has been somewhat different to yours. So you've come from Anglicanism through to independency. But nonetheless, theologically, it's been reformed all the way along, right? The history of our church, so our church has been there since the 1930s, and it was planted as a Pentecostal tent mission. So it wasn't even a church. It was sort of born out of one of these Pentecostal rallies. So it was neither reformed nor even a church in its earliest days. Then from that rally, a church formed. There was a couple of brothers who went around planting Bethel churches in the north predominantly. Okay. So there's a bunch of Bethel churches. So the church my nana went to in Liverpool, it's also called Bethel, Bethel Church Green Lane. That's a sister church of our church, has a similar history, planted by the same group of brothers. Also now a reformed independent church. So it's basically got on the same sort of trajectory. But yeah, so ours has moved from being Pentecostal through to being sort of pseudo-Pentecostal to then being sort of charismatic-y reformed to then being reformed via an Anglican guy or someone from an Anglican background, and then becoming more sort of strict Baptist, really, in its polity. So it's been on a slightly different journey, always independent, but in terms of its polity, different. The reason why I say all of that is because in certain places you get like a board of deacons rather than elders at all. And again, a bit like your PCC, I guess, you have a mix of people on that diaconate board who are kind of elderish and some of them who are deaconish, but all of them are called deacons. And then above them, you kind of have the pastor who runs the show. To be fair to them,
I've been in a Baptist church a bit like that.
Yeah, sometimes you get it in Baptist churches. It's not actually historic Baptist polity that, but you do get it. No. But what's interesting is, and you've got to give it to them on this, what they are actually doing there is taking the first amongst equals principle and just making it explicit. Whereas I think what you sometimes get is places that go, oh, no, we should have elders and deacons, but they still take a first amongst equals idea onto the eldership. So you kind of have an eldership with one guy who is actually, in reality, slightly ahead of the pack, and really they're the ones who are driving everything. Whereas on my understanding of how an eldership should work, though there may be one or two or whoever set aside full-time for the work of teaching the word, principally, all of those elders are formally and functionally equivalent and therefore have the same authority, can all propose, can all reject, can all vote, and all their votes are equal, and not one of them has more of a say over vision. It's genuinely plural and co-equal. Whereas I think in practice, a lot of places, even with a apparently plural co-equal eldership, aren't. But the guys who have this sort of diaconate board of officers, they're kind of being a little bit more honest in a sense, because they've normally got the pastor at a kind of higher rung, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I've seen or been in, like I said, been in the church that was like that, and it was, I mean, it was an interesting one, that, and it, again, that felt Anglican-ish.
Well, it often descends into pragmatism in the end, because what tends to happen is no one's quite sure who runs what exactly, apart from the pastors clearly deemed the top dog. And so then when stuff needs to happen, what tends to happen is it goes not so much along official formal lines. So it's not, here are the elders, everything must be passed through the whole eldership. It tends to be more relational lines. So these are the guys who are, in practice, the ones who control this area or that area or this thing, and therefore to get this thing done, I must do this with them. That tends to be how it works.
Well, it's interesting as well. I think it's tempting, isn't it, these days? I'm drifting a bit, but I was just thinking as you were talking, it's tempting, isn't it? And obviously, it's quite a big thing, and I think in America, isn't it, where they kind of do set things up on a business model, in effect.
Yeah, CEO.
Where you have, you have a sort of, do they call it like an executive pastor? Such a strange title, isn't it?
Oh, well, those guys, they're funny because they're guys who, they call them pastors, but in my book, they're basically doing what I consider diaconal work, which is normally not preaching and teaching and leading. It's all sort of practical, running everything.
Well, in effect, usually, maybe I misread this, but it seems to me that they make sure that everything runs in the church so that you're, whatever they call the senior pastor or something.
It's normally
like
that senior pastor, yeah.
Yeah, then that person basically gets to concentrate on preaching and, you know, maybe doing a bit of pastoral visiting and stuff like that. And, you know, but basically they get to concentrate almost solely on those, you know, and you know, I suppose they would argue it's a kind of gifts thing as well, that, you know, that's what he is gifted in. He's a preacher and a teacher, so let's let him preach and teach. And we've got this business guy who's brilliant at organizing things, so let's let him organize everything so that everything works, kind of thing. And I think it's tempting, isn't it, to sort of, in practice, just thinking of what you're talking about, how things pragmatically tend to fall. Like that happens, doesn't it? You have the deacon or the elder or whoever it is who is quite into the pastoral work, and therefore they kind of run the pastoral stuff. So anyone has a pastoral issue, they go to them. And you have the deacon or the elder who is the teacher and the Bible study producer and that kind of thing. So if it's about that, you go to him. And, you know, and it's easy for it to sort of fall into that. And that's okay, perhaps, in a way, except that you've then sort of broken up you risk the breaking up of the reality of co-equal elders, don't you?
I think the way we would work against that, because that is the tendency. And on one level, we do this. So, you know, of the three elders, different ones of us are strong at different things. And it's natural for either one of us to take a lead in the areas where we're strongest. I mean, that's just sensible management, isn't it? And that's okay. However, what we have to be clear on is not, okay, Dave's the elder for this area and Ian's the elder for this area. We are all the elders for every area. Dave may take a lead on something, but even in taking a lead on it, it still has to run through the entire eldership. And that's where you get problems. It's not when there's a guy who takes a lead, which is okay. It's more when the guy who takes a lead is also the guy who just signs everything off and there is no check within the eldership itself. It's then not an eldership decision, it's an elder's decision, which is different.
Yeah, and also this is the flip side, is it allows other elders to shirk responsibility in a particular area, doesn't it? So, okay, you know, on the pastoral visiting, say, you know, yeah, bloke over there happens to be easily the best of us at that. Therefore, I'm just going to leave it to him to sort out. And I'm not even interested in any of the decisions because it's not the thing. And again, you know, if you've got an eldership, that, okay, you may well be willing to say, well, you are really good at this and we want you to help us because of that. But we can't say we're not involved. You know, we can't sort of just pull out and let you do it.